listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. I'm really thrilled to introduce Isabel Wilkerson. It's been very moving reading this book. Her book, The Warmth of Other Suns, is about the decades-long migration of black citizens who fled the South for the northern and western cities in search of a better life. We were just listening to music when you came in. I don't know if any of you were listening by the late, great Buddy Collette, who was born here in Los Angeles and just passed recently. And his father, from Knoxville, Tennessee, was part of the great migration that Isabel Wilkerson so brilliantly explores in her new book. The book is everything that the rapturous reviews proclaim it to be. It is massive and masterly. It is lyrical and epic in its reach. And as Linnell George so beautifully wrote in the Los Angeles Times last weekend, Wilkerson's book pulls not just the expanse of the migration into focus, but its overall impact on politics, literature, music, sports, in the nation, and in the world. The book details what Isabel Wilkerson rightfully calls the biggest underreported story of the 20th century. She interviewed more than 1,200 people for this book. She says she stopped counting after that. And her commitment to narrative journalism is an example for all of us about the power of stories about so-called ordinary people who, as we all know, are not so ordinary after all. They're never ordinary. And what most entranced me reading it these past days, as well as those big themes, was the beauty of Wilkerson's storytelling, the way she renders the voices and the speech of the migrants, the things they left behind, as she calls it, and the cities they moved away from. And she made me think about the town in Poland that my grandparents left, the town in Russia where my father was born. And reading it, I think, will make you think about Mexico, the El Salvador, the Korea, the China, the Lithuania, that your parents or grandparents left behind, and what it is they brought with them to this country. She makes you understand how the South was still deep within those who left, as evidenced by her exquisite story of how her grandmother tended a night-blooming cereus on the front porch of her yellow bungalow in her southern town, how she alerted the neighbors when it was about to open, and they looked in the flower trying to see the face of the baby Jesus in the folds of the bloom. What she has done with oral histories, as Linnell George wrote, is to stow memory in amber, which I thought was such a beautiful phrase. Isabel Wilkerson is currently the professor of journalism and director of narrative nonfiction at Boston University. In 1994, while Chicago bureau chief of the New York Times, she became the first African-American woman to win the Pulitzer Prize in journalism. She's won many awards, including a Guggenheim and a Journalist Year of the Year Award from the National Association of Black Journalists. She spent 15 years researching and writing The Warmth of Other Suns, which sounds like a very long time, but really this book is enough work for a lifetime. She grew up in Washington, D.C., which was her parents' destination after journeying from Georgia and Southern Virginia during the Great Migration. We are very honored to have in conversation with Isabel tonight Gregory Rodriguez, who's the founder and executive director of Zocalo Public Square. And Gregory has written widely on issues of immigration, national identity, race relations, demographics, and social and political trends for many leading publications. I'm sure most of you read him frequently in the Los Angeles Times, where he's an op-ed columnist. He's a senior fellow at the New America Foundation and the author of Mongrels, Bastards, Orphans, and Vagabonds, Mexican Immigration and the Future of Race in America. Isabel and Gregory will be in conversation, and then they will open it up to you for questions. We will circulate microphones, as we do record for podcast, so please wait until they come to you. And afterwards, we will reconvene in the lobby for the book signing. Please join me in welcoming Isabel Wilkerson and Gregory Rodriguez to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Hi. let me start by thanking Louise. It's a real pleasure to be here and to speak to Ms. Wilkerson. It's an extraordinary book, right off the top. It manages to personal, intimate narratives, poignant stories of loss, of dreams, of sometimes broken dreams. But it recasts a history of African Americans in the 20th century. It's a massive book. But again, and I want you to talk about this. First of all, my first question I'm going to ask you again publicly is, wow.
That's
you,
a question.
Okay, that's it. That's the question. You sought to recast African American history in the 20th century. Were you, a silly question, but let's go with this first. Wasn't that intimidating to be taking on this project?
I'm glad I didn't think of it as intimidating or huge like that. If I had, I wouldn't have approached it. I wouldn't even have tried. What I was trying to do was tell the stories that seemed to be missing from the canon about the 20th century and about the people that I grew up with in Washington, D.C. I was surrounded by people from Georgia and the Carolinas and Virginia. All of them had brought the food and the culture and the music and the folk ways and the values of the South. I grew up around it, and yet I saw no evidence of that really in the general popular culture. It appeared clearly in some of the literature that you read about. There were references all around, but nothing pulling it all together that put it in context. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to pursue it. And I pursued it through three people, right, rather than trying to do the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, what strikes me is we're talking about a mass migration of 6 million people. Why then did we not talk about it? Why was it not part of the canon? And did it really irk you that it wasn't?
And when I mention canon, I mean really the nonfiction canon, because clearly Richard Wright wrote about it, Ralph Ellison wrote about it, but it was all, and their plays, August Wilson dealt with it. But from a historical perspective, it was missing in the discussion of the 20th century. And part of it was because it went on for so long. It went on from 1915 to 1970. So some of the people who were covering it in the beginning, Carl Sandburg was one of the reporters who started it. The poet, he was a reporter in Chicago when it began. Many of those people were gone by the time the migration ended, and people didn't think it was going to end. I mean, people thought that it was over with each section of it. Like at the end of World War I, they thought it was over, and it continued. At the end of the Depression, they thought it was going to be over, and it continued. At the end of World War II, well, it's over, but it continued. Nobody told the people that it was over, so they kept coming. And so it was hard to grasp from that perspective.
But there's plenty of massive phenomena that are hard to grasp. But that doesn't explain why you think it was, essentially, you're saying it was ignored. Why was it ignored?
Partly because the people, too, didn't talk about it. I mean, the people, it was very painful. When the people left, they left for good. And they left behind a caste system that had denied them basic human rights and had humiliated and denigrated them for so long. In some ways, the Great Migration was a defection as much as it was a migration. It was a kind of seeking of political asylum by people who had been held down for too long, and it was the first step that they ever took without asking.
Before I get to that comment on defection, what does it do to our understanding to, again, as I say, essentially recasting a history looking at the migrant experience, the domestic migrant experience of African Americans? How would you like it to change our understanding of the Black experience in the 20th century?
I wrote it because growing up in Washington, my mother went to a great deal of trouble to make sure that I went to an integrated school, which she had not had the opportunity to go to in Rome, Georgia. She actually arranged for a cab to take me across town to a school that she had chosen. It was one of the best schools in Washington. And there I had the opportunity to meet or go to school with people who were children of immigrants, people from actually many diplomats' children from Nepal, from Argentina, from Chile, from Finland. And Also, there were many privileged children from whose backgrounds were from Ireland and Russia and Italy. And there would be certain times where there'd be a discussion about one's background and the lore of immigration. And people on St. Patrick's Day would begin telling stories about their great-grandfather that had come over from the old country. And I felt I didn't have any stories to tell. I was quiet during that time. And I didn't realize that I actually did. Partly because, later I did, but I didn't realize it because no one talked about it. It was so much a fact of life for African Americans in the North and the West. I mean, if you think about it, the majority of all African Americans that you meet in the North or the West are descendants of the Great Migration, and yet no one talks about it. It was too painful. And one of my goals would be that first that people start talking about it. I would love it if people of all backgrounds and ethnicities would read the book, be inspired by the stories that they read, and want to go out to the oldest person in their family to find out the stories before it's too late. I wrote the book with a great sense of urgency because I knew that people were going to be, that time was running out to be able to tell this story. And so I told it with a great deal of urgency and went out looking for people in that way. The other thing about recasting it, the history as you describe it, which I so appreciate you saying, I didn't really think of it that way, is that I felt such a connection when I was growing up to the children of people who were actual immigrants. At lunchtime, it was always a point of stress because my mother would pack a lunch that represented what she thought was the ideal lunch for a child living now in the North. And it was not what the other children who were living in the North were eating. And I had this obsession with liverwurst because that is what other people were eating. And she never packed liverwurst. She actually packed every day Vienna sausages on Wonder Bread with Miracle Whip, not even mayonnaise, but Miracle Whip. And she was quite proud and went to a great deal of trouble of slicing them in half. And she never referred to them as Vienna sausages, but Vienna sausages. and she was, she was doing the very best she could to give what she thought would be. And I'd open up my lunch pail and it'd be the same thing. And other people would be eating, Spam, which was, the highest form of food, it seemed, at that time. And here I had. And so I had this connection with immigrant friends who were from Nepal, and they were bringing in, food that was Nepalese, and children who were from Argentina were bringing the food that their mothers had lovingly prepared, and we all sort of cleaved together because we felt in some ways like outsiders. That's who my friends were. And I realized actually that we all had an immigrant past in a way. And I've been described as a Southerner once removed. So that for many African Americans who are growing up in the North and the West, the idea of being a Southerner once removed is a quite lovely thing. A Southerner said that to me. And so there is this connection between the immigrant heart. I wanted to get at that, the motivations and the heart's desire that would make a person leave one place, the only place they've ever known, for a place they've never seen, in hopes that life might be better with no guarantees at all. And I wanted all of America, all of us of all backgrounds, to recognize that we have so much more in common than we've been led to believe, that we all are seeking to live out the American dream. It's just that African Americans had to do it by leaving one region of their own country to another part of their own country to realize the American dream. But we all have that dream. And these people acted upon that dream. And it's such an honor to be able to write about them. It was an honor to spend the time with them. I have to say that being here in Los Angeles is quite bittersweet for me because I spent so much time here looking for people that I might interview to get to the 1,200 that we were referred to. I went to all kinds of senior centers all on, it's Rodeo on the south side and Rodeo on the north side.
At what point did you realize that?
Oh, very, very well, when they gave me the address. And all up and down Slauson and Crenshaw, all over to St. Bridget's Church and just so many churches and places that I went to try to find seniors, and ultimately identifying and settling on this one amazing man, Dr. Robert Foster. So it's quite bittersweet for me to be here and also to be in this building, because I spent many, many, many hours right here in this building going through microfilm. I mean, it's a miracle now that we have the technology that allows us to find a quicker way to do it. But this is the late 90s, and I needed to get access to the LA Sentinel. And I had to fly in from Chicago in order to read it, because there were references to the people that I was writing about in the LA Sentinel. So I spent many hours waiting for the, you know, getting the cartridges, and then you know, trying to line them up, and they flap, and your eyes begin to blur, looking at page after page, missing the page, because of course you always miss the page you need. you know, so it has a real special place in my heart just to be here in Los Angeles.
This might be a nice segue to the portion that
yes.
Hoping you read.
The book is clearly, you know, kind of big history and covers a great deal of ground, but ultimately it's about people. And this is the person who represents the migration from Louisiana and Texas to Los Angeles. Los Angeles, 1996, which was the year that I met him. The panel door rises a story high and would befit a museum or government office, but is actually the front door of a Spanish revival south of Wilshire. The door opens, and there stands a one-time bourbon-swilling army captain and a deft-handed surgeon who now, in his later years, is a regular at the blackjack tables and the trifectas at Santa Anita. But he is, at the heart of it all, and perhaps most important, a long-standing, still bitter, and somewhat obsessive expatriate from the 20th century South, the heartbreak Jim Crow land he chose to reject before it could reject him again. He is a Californian now, this Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. He is the color of strong coffee and has waves in his hair, which he lets grow untamed as Einstein's, but then brushes back like the boys in the band. He's wearing a white cotton island shirt, loose slacks and sandals, and the uniform of the well-to-do L.A. pensioner. He has the build and bearing of a Sammy Davis Jr., and not a little of the showmanship and the delightful superficiality that seem to grow on people in certain circles of L.A. He walks straight
Don't
back...
Don't nod in agreement.
He walked straight back and slew-footed into the foyer, past the curved faux Gone with the Wind staircase and the East Asian pottery. He gestures toward the living room, an imposing museum of a space that dwarfs him in its volume, fairly frozen in the seafoam carpet and hot pink tulip chairs of a Sherbety Doris Day movie from the 50s. The whole effect is as starched and formal as the tuxedos he used to wear to the parties he threw for himself back when his wife Alice was alive and the money was raining down like confetti. He seems accustomed to people fawning over the place with the prim air of leading men of his favorite movies from back in the 40s, insists on serving his guests a slice of lemon pound cake and vanilla ice cream on Rosenthal china, whether they would like to have it or not, which I did not. I had eaten already. He didn't care. His heavy-lidded eyes look straight into those of his listener and have a distractingly thick fringe of lashes like those seen on babies and starlets. He is a physician, or was for most of his adult life, and by most accounts a very good one, and is prone to pontificate like a man of his years and accomplishments. But he is just as likely to interrupt himself and check the time to see if he can still make the 1 o'clock at the Hollywood Park racetrack. Another story about him here. His photo albums are filled with an unlikely assortment of bookies and blues singers and dentists and fraternity men and surgeons and society people whose approval he craved, even though he knew they were too pretentious to matter, really. He doesn't say it because it would be gauche and hardly worth mentioning from his point of view, but there happen to be a lot of little Roberts around town, not for the reason you think, but rather due to the fact that over the years he delivered a number of baby boys whose mothers were so grateful for him and his firm hand and calming reassurances at the precise moment of truth that they named their sons not after their husbands, but after the doctor who delivered their babies. Before he begins his story, he tells you it's a long one, and you can't get it all. He's lived too many lives, done too much, known too many people, ridden so high and so low that there's no point in fooling yourself into thinking you can capture the whole of it. You could try, of course, and he agrees to give as much as he can. I love to talk, he says, a smile forming on his still chiseled face as he sits upright in his tulip chair. And I am my favorite subject.
Fantastic. Could you take us back to the part in the book when this gentleman arrives in Los Angeles? Because it's, I don't want to ask you to read it, but it's, it makes you feel good about living in LA, but, you know, and we all loved it at one point. Tell us about his when he arrived and what it meant to him and why he didn't choose to live in Oakland.
Mm. He, from the moment he was going to movies as a young boy in Monroe, Louisiana, always dreamed of coming to California. He didn't know anybody in California. He'd heard that there were people in Monroe, Louisiana, where he'd grown up, who had come out to California. Many famous, now famous people came out here, obviously, and went to Oakland, which was the primary destination for people from his part of Louisiana. And two of the famous people who are known for that were Huey Newton, the Black Panther, for, you know, for mixed reasons, he's notorious, and then also Bill Russell, the great NBA player, who whose family left Monroe, Louisiana, because of extreme, you'd have to, you know, read it, it's worth reading, extreme hardship that they experienced. His father had a very bad experience once when he just tried to get gas at a gas station, and he kept waiting to be able to get gas. And by the time he'd been waiting and waiting, and every time a white car came up, he had to wait for them to go first. And he got tired of waiting, and he tried to back out and go to another station. And the owner of the station stopped what he was doing, stopped pumping gas, and came over to him and put a gun to his head and said, "You'll leave when I say you can leave." And that along with so many other things, made the family decide to move. And they ended up in Oakland. But Dr. Foster had this obsession with L.A. And so when he came out here, after a very treacherous journey, which is a whole other thing that I attempted to recreate, he was driving alone out to the West through the desert at night, unable to stop, unable to find a place to rest for the night because they wouldn't permit him a room, and he hadn't anticipated that. So when he finally got here, he actually was a little discouraged and disheartened because he was wondering if he'd made the right decision. Then he got to L.A., and he saw the hedgerows, and he saw the palm trees, and he saw the wide boulevards with the musical, lyrical, lovely Spanish names, La Cienega, La Brea, and just fell in love with it. He just said, "I loved it, loved it, loved it, loved it, loved it."
This is what the book is like.
This is what he was like. And so his arrival was finally what he had been hoping for. And he went through a great deal of trouble to get here to Los Angeles. And he ended up becoming, he had a very difficult time building up his practice. He had to go door to door, very difficult time. But eventually he broke through and became so popular, particularly with other people who'd migrated from the South, that in order to get to see him, people had to wait out in the lobby of his office. They'd have to wait in the hallway of his office. His patients described them as having to wait for hours upon hours upon hours, sitting outside like refugees to see him. And they knew that one of the reasons they were waiting for him is because he was at the track.
Where was his office again?
One was on Jefferson. That was where he had his main one. And then he moved to Santa Rosalia, I think is the name of it.
And his home address again?
1680 South Victoria.
It just helps to ground it for me somehow. Yeah.
See, I remembered. It's all I can do to stop right this minute and head over there, just as an homage to him.
When despite the initial sort of dreaminess of arriving in LA, one part that struck me was the new types of challenges. It wasn't firm, fully segregated Jim Crow South. But L.A. had, I don't want to misremember the name. I think you almost said a sort of a whimsical sort of segregation. Could you describe a little bit? You know, essentially, the rules were not clear here.
Well, there were questions as to where you could go and where you were accepted. He was especially sensitive to anything that might even smack of any different kind of treatment. He had been warned, actually, that in the West, in the South, it's called Jim Crow. And in the north and in the west, it's called James Crow. Because partly because it was always quite chivalrous and pleasant, but still saying no. And that was what he came across when he was trying to cross the desert, and he found that he was looking for a place to stay. And people very politely said that they were out of room, even though there was a sign that said vacancy that blinked, even as he was walking back to the car, so tired that he could barely continue on. And this was well past what we consider to be the South. This was the West. So he ended up having to drive the whole way on his own. It was a drive that I tried to recreate myself with my parents. And I rented a Buick, as he had, in the honor of him and in the spirit of his pride in having owned a Buick at that time, a Roadmaster, which he said rode like a chariot. And I had my parents with me, and everything was fine where we could stop. But then when we got to the stretch where he was not able to stop, it meant that I told my parents, now, at this point, I will continue to drive. You cannot drive, because he had to drive the whole way by himself, and so I wanted to, recreate it to the letter. And I wanted to experience what it was like to have to be gripping the wheel for so long in that one stationary position, and your fingers begin to swell, and they begin to ache, and your eyes begin to want to close so badly with the desire for sleep that they begin to ache, and you begin to veer from the road, and by this time it was darkness, and we were driving through these hairpin turns. At a certain point, my parents said, for all of our sakes, you must stop. And if you don't stop, just let us out. So we made it to Yuma, Arizona, where, of course, we had no trouble finding a room because it was no longer 1953. And neither Jim Crow nor James Crow were in effect. And so I was unable to live it out to the letter, but I tried.
What was this like for your parents? You were doing this. You were working on this for 15 years. What did you put your parents through?
Well, that was they kind of enjoyed it. I mean, my father took notes, and my mother, made commentary along the way. They enjoyed that. One thing that my mother didn't want to do was she didn't want to talk. She was absolutely the toughest interview of all. She just didn't want to talk. But what happened was I read every word of the book to her. Every review I read word to her, word for word to her. And once I started reading part of the book to her, I mean, this was the manuscript before it was published, she began to talk. I mean, it got to a point where I could barely read it to her because she started interrupting and saying, well, when we were in Rome, Georgia, so that was how I got to discover a lot of things about my family. And so every reference that you see in the book to my own family was not something that I knew growing up. It was a result of reporting about my own family. I mean, in other words, interviewing my mother, so to speak. And she eventually began to talk.
I mean, was that the ultimate goal, in a sense? I mean, to learn what your mother never told you?
In some ways, it could be said that. I mean, maybe there is that. In order to have a passion for something, it has to come deep within your heart. And that's a really good point. I mean, basically, the question is, how did we get here? How did all of us get here? And why? And what sacrifices did the people who are responsible for our getting here have to suffer or endure in order to do that? And what were their dreams, and were those dreams realized? I think that was the ultimate question that I had. And I extended that to all the people, the 6 million people who migrated, and their many, many descendants who may not know the answers themselves in their own families.
Can you tell us any more about your mother's reaction as you started to read the manuscript, as she started opening up? I mean, was this cathartic for her? I mean, was it poignant for her as it is for you?
Well, let me just put it this way. She has a shrine to the book. A shrine to the book. That might answer the question for you.
That'll do it. You, You speak of black migrants from the South as defectors. You mentioned that earlier. And in the book, you make, at several points, clearly you make a distinction that black domestic migrants resemble more refugees than economic migrants. And could you tell us what the significance of that is for you?
I think the significance of that is that it means that people were not merely relocating as you would for a new job. You know, your job relocates you, and so that your only interest is in making the most amount of money that you can make. I mean, the goals were very human and very simple. They wanted to be able to walk freely on the streets, not have to step off the sidewalk. They wanted to be able to ride anywhere on the streetcar. They wanted to be able to apply for any job for which they felt they were qualified. They wanted to be able to go to school and have their children be able to go to school, schools that were not segregated. Very simple things. They weren't coming to necessarily run businesses or own huge buildings. They really had very simple, humble goals. And that's the reason why I think the Great Migration is often misunderstood. The goal, many people might look at it and say, well, if it's not successful, if they don't do this or they don't do that. But what were they leaving? And they were leaving a place where it was against the law for black people and white people to play checkers together. They were leaving a place where in many courtrooms there was a black Bible and a white Bible to swear to tell the truth on. And that's so very basic and arcane and insane that they were leaving a place of insanity, and they wanted to be able to have the simple pleasures of being able to walk down the street and not think that they were going to be getting on the bad side of someone just because they didn't bow or step aside. I mean, just very basic things. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, the success of the migration was getting out itself. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference between someone who's going for economic reasons and someone who's going for human rights reasons.
And refugees tend to go to further distances to reach their goals of
Absolutely.
Freedom than an economic migrant who will go for the nearest job.
It's interesting. I ended up going back to very old texts, and one of them is a journal article written in 1885.
A German scholar.
Yes, it was presented in London and to the Royal Society, Historical Society, and it stands to this day as the standard for understanding why human beings migrate from one place to another. And one of the rules is that humans will only migrate as far as necessary to achieve their goal. So it says a lot. It says so much that people were willing to migrate, as much as 2,000 miles away to get as far as they could from the caste system that had held them under for so long. It says a lot. They didn't just move to the next county because that wouldn't have been far enough, or the next state because that wouldn't have been far enough. They actually went as far as they could. And the people, there's a story about Seattle. I mean, that was about as far as you could get. And there are some people who said that L.A. wasn't far enough, so they would go to Seattle.
You bring up the caste system. And one of the most brilliant things of in the book was the effect the caste system had on everybody who lived
yes.
under it. And I wrote down a line of yours, if I could read it. The thick walls of the caste system kept everyone in prison. The rules that defined a group's supremacy were so tightly wound as to put pressure on everyone trying to stay within the narrow confines of acceptability. Could you tell us a little bit about this sort of the oppression of one group over the other led to everyone's oppression?
Well, a caste system, the word caste is a fascinating word because caste system refers to a societal hierarchy that is defined by those in charge to manage the economy in the way that is beneficial primarily to the elites. And a caste, a physical caste, that you put around a limb or a piece of part of your body that needs to be held in place is the same thing. So it's quite interesting that it holds everyone fast in that position, and it hurt everyone. My mother told the story once she started really talking. I mean, once she got started talking, then she wouldn't stop, which I'm grateful for because I got to learn so much. She said that her mother, who took in laundry in order to send her daughters to college, There was one woman who would come, a white woman. These are all wealthy white women who would come to bring their laundry by. And one of them in particular got along just so well with my grandmother. And they would talk and they would chat and they would laugh and they just, whatever, for whatever reason, had just perfectly matched personalities. And yet they knew that outside of my grandmother's living room, they couldn't take it any further. My mother said that they would have been the best of friends in a different time and place. But in that time and place, it was not acceptable. And so how many people, how many black people, how many white people, how many people of all other ethnicities lose out on the potential to have the most wonderful friendships and interactions with people because the caste system kept them from being able to do that? That's just one of the many, many right. ways. Another thing is that if you're degrading someone else, you're degrading yourself. Ultimately, and so it appeared to be hurting one group, and it absolutely did right. hurt gravely the people who suffered so much under Jim Crow, but it also degraded the people who were in charge of it and who were enforcing it.
And one of the ways you put it so beautifully and succinctly is that what was required was controlling the mind of whites in order to control blacks. And when you go to Harlem, let's go to Harlem and the breaking down of the racial barriers. And it was again in the telling of these stories, these brilliant moments of clarification and succinct, you know, explanations of a big process of Harlem, in a sense, making money and the cacophony of a northern city, and the inability to control all whites, to force them to control blacks. So tell us a little bit about that.
That is actually the beauty of the North and the West. Is it the beauty of the North and the West?
Rampant capitalism?
Rampant capitalism and the desire to make money actually work to the benefit of African Americans, because in Harlem and in so many other parts of the country, I use Harlem as an example, but it applied all over the North and West, is that in the South, because the caste system was so fixed and everybody had a stake in maintaining the caste system and everybody knew what the rules were and everybody knew what was appropriate and what was not appropriate, and everybody had a stake in maintaining that. Blacks maintaining it because they wanted to live. Whites maintaining it because it was a way to control and maintain the economy that they all depended upon. However, in the North, there were people coming from all over the place. What are these? You know, the rules were unknown, as they weren't written down in the same way as they were in the South. People were arriving from different parts of the world where they were like, what is this James Crow? We've never heard of a James Crow. Well, who is James Crow? Show us where he is. And so when they got to, when they had apartments that needed to be rented or houses that might be sold, yes, there were covenants in many of the parts of the country, but particularly in New York was especially interesting. No one told them the rules, and so people started selling to African Americans, which is how Harlem came to be. And the idea was that people ended up saying, look, these people are willing to pay us this amount for it. We would like to be able to sell this place. We don't abide by these rules, and we're gonna weigh the consequences, and they decided to go ahead and sell. And so in that respect, they benefited from that. I think that's what you're speaking
absolutely.
About.
You've chosen three major stories that coincide with the three major tributaries of this migration. I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit. I'm sorry, you told me it's not a big deal, but interviewing 1,200 people is pretty extraordinary to me. Tell us a little bit about that process of entering senior citizen, how people, if your mother didn't want to talk to it and every other people didn't talk, how did you get to people take us to a particular senior citizen center, if you will, and how this worked. You just walked in and said, hi.
No, I actually appointments would be made in advance because you couldn't just show up. And I actually had an assistant who would make the calls for me in the beginning stages because there was a huge effort to try to find as many of these people as quickly as we could. So her entire job was just to track down as many of them as we could, make calls, and I would come out to L.A. and show up and begin to talk to people. And so what I would do is I would go in and I would tell them what it was I was doing. It didn't matter at all that I had worked for the New York Times, because what does it matter? We're about to do bingo and you're talking about the New York Times, so they don't care about that.
Totally understandable.
Let's keep our priorities straight. And I would find out what was a good day when they'd have a good turnout, and I would show up and I would make my case. One of the funniest things that happened to me here in L.A., and I tell this all over the country, so I should tell it here, is that at one of the senior centers, I went in and there was a formal program at this one where you had to get on the program, and I was on the schedule. The person on schedule just before me was from the L.A. County Department of Aging. And when he began talking, he made an announcement. He passed out a pamphlet, and he said to the seniors, many of them gathered there. I couldn't wait to get to them because that was where, you know, maybe one of them might be the person in the book. And he said, we're passing out these pamphlets because we're getting alarming reports of strangers coming up to our seniors here in LA County and asking them all kinds of questions and demanding to know their background, where they came from, what did they do for a living, did they own their own home, how many did they have children, and all these things, the personal histories about them. And then what they're doing is, by the time you know it, they have raided their bank accounts and are swindling our seniors. And we want to, so please take the brochure, read it very carefully, and be careful about who you might talk to. Next up, Isabel Wilkerson is here to talk with us about some book she's doing. And I proceeded to make my announcement, and fortunately the people responded to me as, I guess, a child of the Great Migration, and I didn't have any trouble, but it was fascinating. I was quite frightened for a moment. But those are the kind of things that, you know, that you never knew what to expect when you went out to talk with them.
What were the great sources of migration to Los Angeles? Where were they from?
Primarily Texas and Louisiana. California draws people from all over the world. So you will find people from all over. But the main source, the main contributor to the African American experience here in Los Angeles would be those two states. And there were many actual clubs that were built around certain towns. There was a Monroe, Louisiana club. There was a Lake Charles, Louisiana club. There were multiple Texas clubs. There were multiple New Orleans clubs. And the people would gather together, and they would have oxtail soup and red beans and rice and talk about the old country. There was often an exile obsession in some ways and fascination. There's a reference in the book where I had to go through a great deal of trouble to get to be able to attend one of the meetings of the Monroe, Louisiana club. Very difficult. Dr. Foster had to go and put a good word in for me and say that I was actually a quite decent person. And then when they finally accepted me, and there were only about 12 people at this particular meeting, and at the beginning of it, there was always a prayer, and they prayed. A man stood up there and he says, we are praying for the lady visitor and the book she's trying to write. They didn't quite know exactly where this was leading, but, you know, we pray for her.
And such clubs are still around.
They're waning, though, as the original migrants are leaving us.
Some of the most poignant little vignettes are those between family members, those who stayed and those who went, and the scenes of people visiting back south and they're treated as dignitaries. And
yes.
And there must have been some resentment as well of those who left. And they were. So could you tell us a little bit of, because that's something of other migrations, that this notion of you're proud when they leave, but you kind of resent them because they don't need you anymore. And tell us a little bit about that back and forth.
Well, I love the idea of the return, because I got the sense for the most part that they were giddy and excited and worked very hard to, I actually have talked with people in my own family about what would happen when my mother would go back and visit long before I was born, and my cousins would tell me that we cleaned up for days. Down came the draperies. We were on our hands and knees with the Johnson wax. I mean, all these stories about preparing for them. And the people in the North were preparing to come back. They had to show that they were successful. They might have once, one told me that they would shop for a year. The moment they left, from visiting the South. Some would go back every year around Easter or be the 4th of July, but they might have one time when they would go back. And from the moment they were on the way back to the North or the West, they began saving up for what they were going to wear for the next time they visited. And they had a way of, they wanted to show off how much money they had, so they had what, you know, what they call them, the big city wad of money, wad of cash, where there'd be all these ones on the inside and they'd have a 20 or a 50 on the outside. And the little kids would just ooh and ah over all the money that the people were making up north. So there was a show being put on by both sides, as both sides wanted to show that they had made the right decision. There also was the expectation, as with any immigrant experience, just a human thing, that those who left felt this obligation, this responsibility, and a desire to help those who had stayed, and so they would send money back. And the money that they would send back was often used to help with the family responsibilities, but also to help finance the civil rights movement as we knew it, as time passed on. The Great Migration was a precursor to the civil rights movement in many ways.
I wanted to just go back to the early 20th century and the beginning of the Great Migration. And you set it up with this notion that this is a new generation that was unlike any other previous generation of African Americans, I wrote down your notes. Young people with no personal recollection of slavery, two generations removed, and what was striking was the sense that any of the, I think the term you used was contrived intimacy between blacks and whites that may have existed during slavery, did not exist at all during the earlier stages of Jim Crow. And so why did that make a difference? What was in the nature of that particular generation that would lead them to leave?
That's a really good point. I mean, there are several things on both sides. First of all, there was no form of bonding. Whatever bonding might have occurred during slavery, and there could have been, you know, just by proximity alone, there would have been the opportunity for people to have had an interdependence, a codependent relationship, even if it was completely imbalanced and cruel on some level. There was at least a connection between the two. And this meant that there was really, Jim Crow meant that there was no opportunity. As we said, it was against the law for a black person and white person to play checkers together. So that meant that there was even less of a connection to the land of their birth. It also meant that life got meaner and harder for people than it had been before, because that meant that the whites who might have been there had no sense of the kind of even paternalistic intimacy that might have been there before, when they had a vested interest in African Americans remaining healthy or whatever because they owned them. Here there was no connection at all. So it was the worst of all possible worlds. I mean, it was very difficult actually to write about the introduction of Jim Crow, because you have to think as an African American about your own forebears who might have had to live under Jim Crow, because Jim Crow was not a one-day thing. It was a slow rise of ugliness and separation of entire people within the South. And it was in some ways the way Nazism was a slow tightening of the vise that meant that where you had freedoms before, each day there were fewer and fewer and fewer things that you could do. And there are so many similarities between that kind of tension. And I felt such a sickening feeling when I thought about the people in my, you know, my family who had to live through that. Everyone who was African American at that point had to live through the tightening of the vise. And so that's the reason why that's also what propelled people to leave. They were more likely to leave because they had less reason to stay than ever before. Also, the North opened up at that exact same time. So it was the perfect moment, the perfect storm. The North opening up because it needed workers for World War I, and the South actually tightening its grip over every aspect of a black person's life. And it only got worse over time as they created more and more rules. At one point, it was actually in one place in South Carolina, you could not, blacks and whites who were working in the same building could not go up the same staircase. What are the logistics of that? I mean, how do you even do that? I mean, it just gets to the point where it's almost untenable and unworkable. And yet that was the kind of thing that was beginning to, these are people who had been freer during Reconstruction, and they were now finding things were tightening up. Just as the moment they were feeling that things were opening up, they were tightening up. So it had to be at a particularly disheartening time for all of them. And that's the reason why, you know, the Great Migration also had that other, that extra push.
I wanted, before we open it up, there's one other just brilliant moment in this. Is not long after this, what she's talking about now, the when the migration has obviously in has gained steam, the newspaper in Macon, Georgia, right? Macon, Georgia. This is an editorial you found.
Yes.
Quote, "We must have the Negro in the South. It is the most pressing thing before this state today." This extraordinary reaction, like, oh my gosh, they're leaving. And I was wondering, I mean, it's, if you could, just for, we're going to open it up, but I just wonder if you had any thoughts on that. Was, did then, were there struggles within sort of the white establishment as to maybe we should treat them better? Tell
absolutely.
Us a little bit about
the moment. The editorials were rich with discussion. It was the major issue of the day during that period.
Sort of delicious, isn't it? Sort of,
the major issue of the day. And they couldn't figure out whether we should treat them better so that they would stay or whether we should actually tighten it up so that they will actually be more afraid to leave. Yeah. They actually would, if they saw large numbers of black people on the railroad platforms, they would arrest them wholesale because they were under, you know, whatever terms they wanted, for whatever reason they wanted, but primarily for peonage laws, meaning that you're supposed to be working. You are basically that you were here to work and you're not working and you're here on the platform, so you're under arrest. Or they would be charged with owing a debt to the planter for whom they worked. There would be all kinds of ways they would do that. They would actually board the train when they saw lots of black people on them and actually arrest them and pull them off the train. And then when those things didn't work, they would actually wave the train on through if they saw that there were many of them waiting on the train, waiting on the platform, because then they wouldn't be able to go at all. On the other hand, they, when it came to the demand side, meaning the North wanting them, they extracted these exorbitant fees from the North from companies that wanted to recruit black people in the South. They, in Macon, they demanded $25,000 of any recruiter who wanted to bring in to recruit black workers who were living in the South. And if they were found to be recruiting without having this licensing fee that they'd paid, then they would be facing a year's hard labor, that recruiter. And that's not something you'd want in Mississippi or Alabama or Georgia in 1918.
And all this made people leaving their experience more like refugees, because
more
they
like
often left surreptitiously.
And could not tell people. The woman who left Mississippi for Chicago, Ida Mae Gladney, one of the protagonists in the book, they slowly, once they decided they were going to leave, they slowly divested of what little they had, moved quietly the day before to basically position themselves to leave from her mother's house, and didn't tell anyone until they were gone. And she said, you just didn't tell people you were leaving. You couldn't.
Isabel Wilkerson, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Some time for Q&A, and there's a young woman with a microphone back there, so if you want to raise your hand. Sure. Oh, you mean me? Well, you're closest for the time, so let's do that.
I'm looking forward to reading the book, but as a historian, I guess I would want you to talk a little more about how you're revising because I don't think of the Great Migration as being quite so absent from the historical record as your introduction made it seem. And in particular, I'm kind of interested in how you think of your book in comparison, say, to Promised Land by Nicholas Lehman.
Well, first of all, this is the first book, absolutely, you know, the first. There was a point where I was reading a book a day, so I kind of think I've read almost anything that had the word migration in it, including about birds by accident. but this is the first book to describe the migration North, Midwest, and West. There is no other book that does that. And there needed to be, and also talking about it from the full breadth of it. There are many, many books that might talk about, from a scholarly perspective, the World War I migration. There are many scholarly books that talk about the migration to Milwaukee. There's a famous book by Abraham Epstein about, and a wonderful book, from the World War I migration to Pittsburgh. Absolutely fabulous, by an economist. He was an economist. Wonderful book. So there are many pieces of it, but it's so huge that it is daunting. I mean, getting to your first question, I mean, who would even... I had to have been a total innocent to even have attempted this, because it is so huge. And so this is the only book that pulls together the entire 55-year history of the migration, from all the main migration streams. And more importantly, and perhaps most importantly from my perspective, the missing piece has always been the voices of the people who did this. Always been the voices of the people who did this, from my perspective.
Hi, Isabel. I'm Almeida. Anyway,
Thank you, Almeida. Everybody needs to know that. I used to go to so many places, St. Bernadette's...
Bridget.
St. Bernadette's, the center, too.
Right.
But so many places I would go, and I would ask people these questions about looking for people who had migrated. And a woman came up to me at one of those places, and she said, "I know the perfect person for you." And when you hear that, you say, "There." It's almost like someone finding you a blind date. There's no way you could possibly know the perfect person for me. No way in the world. And this is Almeida, who identified Dr. Foster for me. So I want to give her a hand.
Oh, that's so kind. I just want to first of all commend you for a job well done, because when we first met and I took you to visit with him, and after a couple of years or so, he passed on, and I called you, and you came, and you were there, and that was the last time I saw you. And I often wondered what happened with all of this stuff you talked about. And so now I'm hearing it, and I really commend you, and I congratulate you, and I hope that it will continue.
No, the woman two doors down, two seats down.
Thank you for such an engaging story. I'm an educator. I teach high school in East Los Angeles, and as you know, our graduation rate is about 45% of incoming ninth graders will graduate 4 years later. Few of them, only 8 of 100, will be qualified for admission to a University of California. Wow. So John Ogbu wrote a study in the late 1900s about push-pull immigration and the children of those immigrants and how well they do in school. And it's obvious that the pull immigrant children do much better in school than the push immigrants. He wrote a footnote to the study that he did that I read that said, you have to accept the Hispanic children in the southwestern United States because they're victims, my word, of conquest. So, and black children are the same. So what are your insights to teaching and learning and helping those kids be successful?
I really appreciate that question. I think that part of the challenge for African Americans or any group that has suffered persecution is, what do you do with the pain that you've experienced? And I don't mean the pain of the moment. I mean the pain that is inherited through the generations and the not talking about it. And my goal with this is to begin to, in some ways, give recognition to the survivors of that and to learn from how they survived. If they don't talk about it, then you can't know the they're not passing on the strengths and the fortitude and the methods that they used in order to overcome or to rise above the challenges that they faced. I mean, there's so much inspiration from just the ability to survive what they did. And then the determination and the vision and the strength to be able to leave the only place you ever knew for a place that where there are no guarantees. I mean, I think that there's so much inspiration within. And I think that people look to the outside for heroes, look to the outside. One of the things that's beautiful about this migration is that there was no leader. In fact, the leaders were against the migration. One of the examples in the book is of a minister in Florida who told his flock, "Don't leave. There's nothing for you in the north. The south is the place where the forefathers have built it. Let's stay here. Things might get better. You can bear up under it," and on and on and on. And the next day, he was stabbed for saying that. These are church-going people. Stabbed the minister. You think about it. What I'm saying is that this is to me, I get great inspiration by thinking about and contemplating and studying and learning the stories of the experiences of the people who went through this. And I think if more families talked about where they came from and why, how you end up here, how did so many people end up here in California, in Los Angeles? You didn't just sprout up here out of nowhere. And knowing the history, and knowing where they came from and why someone in all of these families did a very brave and courageous thing. I mean, to come out to California is not easy. There's something special about the people who come out to California. And that's because... Oh.
Now you say it.
Yeah, because first of all, it takes so much in the way of resources. If you're coming from the South, this is the farthest possible point you can come to the West Coast. You have to have resources, you have to have vision, you have to have courage, you have to have stamina. You often have to have some type of money, have saved up money, because it would be so much easier maybe to go to Cleveland, but they chose not to. And so there's a reason why they are here, and I think that people have lost touch with why they're here. And those values have not been passed down through the generations, the good things about the South. I mean, the hard work, the idea that you work a long day for a day's labor. Hopefully, many of them worked without being paid, so they were so happy to be able to get paid. The role of religion and spirituality. A lot of those things got pushed behind by turning away. Some people even changed their name. Those values got lost, and I think it's an attempt to reclaim the values of that. One of the things about the book was I wanted to work very hard to maintain the language of the people, not as a mockery of the language, but as a way to retain part of the culture and the discussion about the food and all of the folkways and the music. And there's so many amazing people who were part of this migration. I mean, Tom Bradley, the first black mayor of Los Angeles, was a part of this great migration. His parents had been sharecroppers in Texas. Going up to from him to Snoop Doggy Dogg. I mean, for the young people who, if they want to look up to him, I mean, whoever, whatever it may be.
Where was his family from?
From Mississippi. And there are so many other famous people. I mean, Motown wouldn't exist if it weren't for the migration. Jazz would very likely not exist if it weren't for the Great Migration. Miles Davis, his family migrated from Arkansas to Illinois, where he had the ability and the time, the luxury to be able to pursue music. Thelonious Monk, his family migrated from North Carolina to Harlem when he was 5 years old, where he also had the luxury. It would have been incredible self-indulgence to be in tobacco country. But to be playing piano for hours on end, it would have been impossible to do that. And John Coltrane migrated from North Carolina to Philadelphia when he was 17, where, believe it or not, he got his first alto sax. I mean, where would we be without that? Toni Morrison, her parents migrated from Alabama to Ohio. There are so many people who benefited from this great migration. And a lot of the success, I would argue, with any immigrant group is the degree to which you are able to maintain the best of what it was in the original place of the original homeland. There are good things about those places and good values that were there. And then adopting the best of the new place that you happen to be of your adopted land. And that, to me, is the recipe for the best kind of success that there might be. And I think that it's been lost kind of on both ends. The worst possible scenario is to forget where you came from and adopt only the bad things about the place where you are, which is what is happening in some cases. I think that may be what you're talking about. There needs to be more balance. And my goal is that by recognizing what the history is, things might change.
Right here in front, and then you.
It was interesting when you said your parent, or especially your mom, was reluctant to talk. And sometimes my youngest is 28, and I want to reflect on or warn her about certain things, but I don't want to quench her spirit. the spirit of being who you want to be. Did you find that when you, did you finally ask your mom why it took her so long to open up?
Oh, I knew why.
Okay.
She said, that's in the past. That's so long ago. You know, I mean, that was what she would say. I think that a person has to be ready to hear it. I think that the idea is that, you know, you can't, you know, open up the brain and then just start downloading things. I think that it has to be a matter of when the time is right, sharing the values, letting people know what the, you know, what grandma did or what grandfather did, and finding ways to find heroes and people to be proud of in your own family. And there are people to be proud of in all of our families. I mean, the beauty is, again, there was no leader. There was no Malcolm X. There was no Martin Luther King. There was no Harriet Tubman leading this migration. These were the individual decisions of people who said to themselves, we're not going to take it anymore. We're going to go someplace else. They made this decision to leave, a huge life-altering decision. And I just think that by passing along those stories, when it's appropriate, when someone's ready to hear it, it can help give a grounding and a foundation to that. And also the celebration of the culture that you come from is also a part of it, too.
Hello. I've been really eager to read your book, and finally we waited to get the copy tonight and flip through it, and I noticed there's no photographs. Oh. So I wondered what your decision was in not having any illustrations.
That's a really great question. This book is a narrative. The goal is for the reader to lose herself or himself in the stories of these people, to imagine what it would be like to be out there facing an entire field of cotton and having to pick 7,000 bowls of cotton, 7,000 feathers in order to get 100 pounds of cotton, and to imagine what it must be like to be held and dangled over a well when you're 6 years old by two strange men, as what happened to Ida Mae Gladney. We did not want you to be distracted by, you get halfway through and you see, oh, she did make it to Chicago after all. <You know? laughs> And so it is a narrative where the goal is for you to lose yourself in the story. Every word was written with an idea of propelling you forward as a person would be propelled on the train. And it was a simultaneous decision on the part of myself and my editor that there would be no photographs. There is a website. The photographs are not up, but they will be going up because I've been getting this demand for the photographs, and they will be going up of these individuals. So,
gentleman back there, let's start with.
How you doing? I wanted to thank you very much for including jazz and the Motown sound affected by the migration to New York, Detroit. And wanted to include the migration that happened in Chicago with Muddy Waters, Willie Dixon, and John Lee Hooker. Wasn't for that type of migration, Chicago wouldn't have the blues festivals that they have ongoing. And thank you for bringing the music up, because I'm going to convey this back to a Taylor member of your family.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I want to respond to that. First of all, I will let my cousin know that you made yourself known. But I chose not to dwell on blues. Blues is referred to. But the goal is to impart things that you didn't know. I didn't realize the connection between jazz and the Great Migration when I started this. I didn't realize that Motown would not have existed. If you think about it, you know that. But I wanted to connect the dots here. And the connection between Chicago and the blues in Mississippi is well-trod soil, and I wanted to be able to show, I include that, but I wanted to show that it was even bigger than that, because the migration was even bigger than one of the main one of the streams of the migration is much bigger than that. So it's a part of it, and it's all part of the what makes American culture distinct was the transfer of the Southern culture to the North. Actually, these people were a great bridge between the South and the North, and all of that comes together and creates a whole new art forms, which are also the legacy of the migration.
We have time for 2.5 more questions. Let's start with him.
Hi, Isabel. My name is Chris. What thing or what happened in your research to tell you, this is a point to finish? You know, why not, you know, 5, 10, 15?
When she started reading books on the bird migration.
Yeah, exactly. Good answer.
It seemed as if, you know, you could go another 5 or 10 years.
But no, I couldn't. Thing, no, I couldn't. No, I could not.
What thing happened that told you, oh, this is a good point for me to finish?
Great question.
It's difficult to answer that question because I don't want to give away. It's like a spoiler alert. You will know when you complete the book that this was the right place to end it. And I don't want, it's not as if there's some great big, you know, wisdom or a certain thing, but it's just that it found a natural ending that made itself available to me, and it just seemed like the right place. In fact, the ending was written quite early in the process. I kind of knew early on where it needed to end. It needed to end with one particular character at a particular point in that person's life, and that's where it ends. So it just felt very organic. I mean, a lot of people ask about, was there an outline? I had no outline. It was a very organic process. I just knew when it was supposed to stop, but it was all in my head, and it just needed to come out, and it took all this time to come out. So I hope that that answers your question. It's hard to
this gentleman right there. Sorry. Yes. Mm-hmm. Sorry about that. Yeah. We have to
get you out of here. Yeah. As it happens, my name's also Chris, but
okay, no,
I am a
You've
refugee.
You've already had your question.
I'm a refugee from Rome, Georgia, as it happens.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. You leave Rome.
South or north?
Well, I would say Rome was not left in a day. I have a very problematic relationship with Rome, and I still go back there.
My mother does too. So.
Annually.
But she doesn't go back. But that's
well, I do. But maybe 10 years ago, I went with my mom doing some, you know, antique shopping and that kind of thing, and I saw two men in their probably late 70s at a small restaurant having lunch together, a black man and a white man. And I thought, that could not have happened even during my childhood.
Wow.
Right? That would not have happened. And so it's really quite interesting to think about the people who stayed. For me, that's a really powerful thing to think about. And then just one quick anecdote. I went out to dinner in LA a week and a half ago with an 85-year-old friend of mine who moved here in 1947. Okay, white gay man who told me that into the 60s you would call a restaurant before you went with a black date to see if they would serve you. So these stories are sort of, it's a very good time for these stories to emerge. I mean, you can see everybody here would like to sit down and talk with you for about a week.
Yeah.
So thank you. I cannot wait to dive into this book, but thank you for this work.
Well, one of the things I'd like to say about the people who stayed is it was necessary for the progress in this country toward human rights for there to be people in the South and the North. This was a redistribution of an entire people. At the beginning of the migration, there were 90% in the South, and at the end of the migration, nearly half of all African Americans were living outside of the South. So it is a huge redistribution. But it was necessary for people to stay and to basically face the final moment of truth in the South. There needed to be people there to face the hoses and the dogs and the sheriffs. And they were being, in some ways, supported both spiritually and financially by the people in the North and also by the people in the North leaving. They helped create an opportunity for those to see what was possible. And also to have a refuge if they needed to get out, if things got very difficult. But the beautiful thing about the people who stayed is that they often, it's been said that some have told the people who left, they said, we must stay here so that you will have a place to come back to visit. They are the keepers of the culture, the original culture of wherever your people happen to be. Cool. And it's important that there be people who stay. And that's a beautiful thing.
Well, one last question. You were waiting, I think, right there, yeah. I didn't see the hand, sorry.
Thank you for doing this. I'm a former resident of Chicago, and maybe this is too long and complicated a question, but I remember growing up in such a segregated city, and to this day it is. And you talk about Los Angeles and almost as the promised land. Chicago couldn't have been for the African Americans who came, because I saw the oppression. and it's very, very painful to think about it now. You know, growing up, you kind of go along with it, and then it's, whoa, you know, the segregation and the housing and everything.
Well, the thing is, Chicago is one of the cities that I write about. That there are three cities, Chicago, New York, and L.A. I spent most of my time tonight talking about L.A. because we're in L.A. But again, it gets to how do you define success? What was it that they were seeking? Just by getting out of the South, things were better, but that didn't mean it was perfect. They weren't expecting perfection. And in some ways, leaving was the whole point. It's so sad and tragic what happened in the North, and we don't have enough time to get into that, unfortunately. I do address it directly in the book. One of the greatest tragedies was it when these people from all over the country, all over the world rather, arrived in these cities from different places, wherever they might have been, whether they were from Eastern Europe, Southern Europe, from South America, from parts of Asia, all of them arriving in the big cities as essentially the same person. They were all very similar. They were all often people of the land who were being persecuted, whether economically, politically, or whatever, back home, and they were coming to this country, to the big cities of the North and the West, in order to find freedom and to pursue the American dream. And when they got here, instead of being able to recognize and see the commonalities, they were torn asunder because some could join unions, some could not. Some could live in wonderful neighborhoods, and some were penned into what became ghettos. And they never got a chance to really know one another. We shouldn't make that mistake any further. There's no reason to make that mistake any further, and I hope that people will learn from that out of this book.
You have to sign some books, and you have to get on a plane, and we have one more question.
Hi, my name is Aisha. I haven't read your book yet either, but...
It rocks.
The title intrigued me, The Warmth of Other Suns. Where did you get that inspiration for the title?
The title comes from a passage from the autobiography of one of the most famous people who ever left the South for the North. It was Richard Wright, and he was one of the great novelists of the 20th century. He wrote Native Son, but he also wrote a phenomenal autobiography, which I think is amazing and actually maybe truer. And
can you take us out with this?
Read it?
Can you just
read
it?
That's a good way to end it.
That would be lovely.
And I think you're right. I agree. It reads, I was leaving the South to fling myself into the unknown. I was taking a part of the South to transplant an alien soil, to see if it could grow differently, if it could drink of new and cool rains, bend in strange winds, respond to the warmth of other suns, and perhaps to bloom.
Let's thank Isabella.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Boujakji Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and public television station KCET. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. A loud theme composed by Larry Karish.